Welcome back. Continuing on with the topic of release management. Who wants to even release their software in production? Ah, whatever. It's all about you?
Yeah,
oh, okay. All right. I mean, it's all about fancy ways to provision the infrastructure, right? And test it. Mm. Oh, wait. Well, yeah, we probably need to do something about that. So that's what we're going to talk about here, right? What do we say when we talk about release management? Well, you're probably going to have some type of source repository, of course, DevOps, that as we've beat on the drum throughout the course of the day, they both are going to need to have access and collaborate and share through this whole system. You're probably going to have some form of infrastructure configuration as code, but then here's the trick, right? How do we make this happen in an automated fashion to those environments, and how do we transition that code or that app code into those other environments that are there? So how do we kind of move that through the pipeline? Well, the overall business value that we were talking about here is the optimized resources, right, is one of the things, because you now know exactly what's running inside of each of those environments, and you're also going to have in a way to accelerate the delivery there. One of the analogies that I like to use is if you are going to be going 200 miles an hour on a bullet train, you probably need to have some rails, right? Because, and so that's kind of how I look at release management, right? If you're eventually wanting to say, I'm going to deploy multiple times a week or whatever, you're going to need to have some guidelines on making an efficient system to have those releases go through the pipeline. So release management really helps with that. It's going to help with a number of things on that finishing mile, but you are going to have a faster deployment rate. You're going to have a quicker mean time to resolution because you have the ability now to probably roll back or roll forward a little easier. You also have a consistent process for the different environments and making sure that it's not just Bob who changes the configuration as code script variable to a different number. It's like you have a defined process for what that looks like for when you release it from dev to staging, for instance. Naturally, that's going to result also in higher availability for your business, because any of those potential room for errors in switching between environments are going to be minimized. What are the open source tools that relate to this that we're going to talk about here? And those are Hudson and Jenkins. What is Hudson? What does that do? Well, here I've got a screenshot of kind of some of the things that might happen. In the side of the Hudson console here, we have the option to say, add a new cloud, Microsoft Azure. We add that cloud subscription. Once we add that cloud subscription, in this particular feature of integration, we are going to add instances to be provisioned as slaves as it's listed here. What does that mean? So we should explain here. So Hudson, at a high level, right, enables you to do builds and potentially integration and deployments. Well, if, let's say, that Hudson server is overloaded, right, that virtual machine perhaps is just got too many jobs for processing builds, at some point it may need a helper. In this case, they call it slave, but something to distribute that load, right? The integration here that we're providing is that Hudson master server to be able to provision VMs that help offload that workload from the master to be able to do those jobs. If we go back to the slide, we can see that you also have the ability to upload artifacts and links into the blob storage, which is another integration point that we have here. And as you can see here, there's a couple of screenshots of what that looks like inside of the console. I don't have a Hudson demo for you today, but those are kind of some of the integration points that we have with Hudson and Microsoft Azure.
So you're going to do a Jenkins demo, right?
I will.
Yeah, so it's worth pointing out a little piece of history here, that Hudson and Jenkins come from the same code base. And so the demo that you're going to do on Jenkins here is almost transferable, almost completely transferable over to Hudson. Certainly the plugin that you're going to demonstrate, there is a Hudson version of that. So when you do the Jenkins demo, consider it a Hudson demo as well.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so good history behind that. I'm sure there's more to that story, but good to know.
Yeah,
that
people can read up on it.
People can read up it if you want to. but for now, it's just good to know that these are similar. And so when I get into Jenkins here, after we cover the why of Hudson, then you'll know that these are similar. So why Hudson, right? This can help with, you know, availability of your build artifacts or downloadable dependencies. You know, again, if you may have existing investments in Hudson or Jenkins, you may have a system of orchestration for doing those builds and deployments. And, you know, being able to have a highly performant solution to, let's say, scale the builds across a number of different machines is some other reasons why you might use Hudson or Jenkins. And then, of course, again, we've got a couple different plugins here. So Microsoft OpenText has a Hudson plugin for the storage as build artifacts, and also has the ability to deprovision virtual machines to offload some of that job processing from that master. Okay, what is Jenkins? Well, back to kind of what we were saying here, very similar concept. You have the ability to do builds, deployments, and connect that up to your pipeline of releasing your code into your environments. And, you know, we have that ability to connect this up to, as you see down on the bottom of that icon, Team Foundation Server. So we can connect the Jenkins to the TFS repository so that when we do check in our code to the Team Foundation server, we could do that continuous integration to fire off a new build, tests, and possibly do continuous deployment if everything passes from this system. Why might we do this? Again, another hash or variety of kind of the why behind Hudson. You're probably not going to use both Hudson and Jenkins. You're going to probably pick one or the other. And you know, it's going to help really enable that higher level quality of software if you've got an automated pipeline to do tests and other things that are behind it. And again, back to the kind of release management why of having a pipeline to help push things in an automated fashion into your environments. With that, I'm going to go to a demo.
What, you're going to do a demo?
I know. Open source David and Jenkins. You know, we are. I am not going to claim to be a Jenkins expert by any means.
Hey, I did Windows. You can do Jenkins.
There we go. Yeah. There we go. Hey, it's a new world, right? So let's go to my machine. And the first thing we're going to do is kind of give you an idea of the different options on starting to create a Jenkins server, right? A Jenkins master server. How can Azure facilitate that? Now, we talked about a number of the different ways earlier. We had the VM Depot, and within the VM Depot earlier, we showed how you could go in, provision a new virtual machine via this means. So I will spare us from doing that walkthrough right now, but I want to highlight something that's really important here, and that is that if you're using the VM Depot, the VM Depot really has all of the community submitted images, right? There's no like quality bar or anything like that. If you submit it into there, it's going to exist. However, once you go to the VM Depot source via either of the Azure portals, you get a slightly more restricted view of what images show up there, because naturally Azure wants to have a kind of minimum quality bar, so to speak, before we pass those images out for people to deploy. So to illustrate that in the demo here, I'll just show you quickly kind of what that looks like. So here we can
just before you go on, yeah. So I just want to make it clear that although there is no quality bar on VM Depot in terms of if it's community provided, it can go on there. We do test the machines as they go on, make sure that they boot up, that kind of thing. So there's no implied support, I think, is a better way of putting it rather than the quality.
Okay.
Whereas if you go and put it from the Azure Gallery, they have images on there that are only images that are on endorsed distributions of Linux. So there's a level of known functionality on VM Depot. You can get it on many distributions that aren't necessarily endorsed. So it's buyer beware on VM Depot. On Azure, still buyer beware, but there's an extra layer on top.
Okay.
So
much better said than I, as the person on that team.
Don't be too scared of using BMD power.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So you guys do have a quality bar in the VM Depot.
Yeah.
It's just a little bit different as you described.
Yeah. It's definitely lower than it is over on Azure Gallery.
Okay. Cool. Okay. So to kind of highlight that point, just so you see it in action here. If we go to this list, VM Depot, for instance, you see three different instances of Jenkins, for instance. Whereas if I go to the new Azure portal, so if I were to go to new virtual machines, scroll down to this list, and here we have, don't get nauseous yet. Okay, there we go. So we have VM Depot community images, which highlights that same source repository. If we go there, we can notice we have two images from on Jenkins, which are slightly older builds.
Yeah, in fact, you can get a newer build on VM Depot in this instance.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now there is yet a third way to access VM Depot today, anyway, which I will highlight here. If we go to the existing management portal, and this is also a little bit buried, if you go into virtual machines and you go to images, here you have down here a bottom, and you have the ability to say browse VM Depot. Now, this VM Depot is not a part of the current management portal here's experience to do new VM. So if I go to browse VM Depot here, here is where we will see the different Jenkins images in another hash of this view. So if I go down to this list, let's see here. So here we actually see a slightly larger view, and we do see the 1.588 image. Now, if I were to go and do this, and click next, I have the ability to say what essentially I'm going to be doing is pulling down that VHD into my storage account that I've defined. So if I click on this and say, yep, I want to pull it down, what you can see here is that it's retrieving the status. It's actually pulling down from that repo into my storage account. Once I have that there, there's a little checkbox that we don't have time to wait for, but it just says register this image. Yep. When you register that image, it now becomes available for you to provision a new virtual machine. So if I click on new, and I say from gallery this time, when I go to this list, there's an option down here which says my images. Okay, and so my images is where you'll see, after you register this gallery image, you'll see it pop up in this list. So here we can see, because I've already downloaded the latest version of Jenkins earlier, I now have the ability to go through, I'm not gonna go through this wizard, but you've seen this before. You go through the wizard, you create now a VM based on that VM Depot image that's up there in the gallery.
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing here is the natural progression of ease of use of all of these different tools and things. I mean, we saw the demo earlier on today about the easy deploy from VM Depot, which if you want access to all the communities, it's as close as you can get to a single click deployment. You only have to provide a password, really. That's ultimately it.
Yeah.
The new portal, you don't have to do all that, copying it down into your own images and bringing it across, et cetera. In the new portal, you can deploy it just like any other VM. And then the somewhat cumbersome view that you've just looked at there it's somewhat cumbersome.
Yeah.
But indeed, you can access all of the images that are available. And then, of course, you have the command line.
of course, there's command line to automate the install. Right.
Yeah.
So we've shown you a lot of different ways. A lot of the open source tools, as you've seen throughout the day, right, really come back to VMs and VM images. So hence why we've kind of been showing you all different ways to slice and dice and create these various images that you can go and utilize inside of Microsoft Azure.
Yeah, the idea is find the process that works.
Yeah, find a process that works for you. And you can already see how with the preview portal we're evolving and helping things move along as well, because one of the big points of feedback we had in the current management portal is I can't find it. And that's understandable, because most people just go new gallery and then it's not there, right? So, but that's now in the gallery for the new preview portal. So you can see how that's really, helping folks out. So I want to actually transition to show Jenkins and show some of the integration. So we'll kind of keep going here in this list. So if we snap back to my demo machine here, you can see that I already have a running Jenkins virtual machine. And if I go into this virtual machine, you can see that I have opened up ports for the HTTP and HTTPS, and I've listed the public and the private port the same. So effectively now, when I go to my Jenkins vmdemo.cloudapp.net, I now have a Jenkins server. Now, just a short tip here. The username and password is for Jenkins anyway. There's a username and password for the Linux VM. But there's also a username and password for Jenkins. That is available inside the details of this list. So if you see here, in case you, like me, didn't read
the last part.
Yeah, who reads the manual, right? In case you didn't read the manual and read all the way to the end of that blurb, the username is user and password is password to initially log into that Jenkins.
And you find that with most images that have a username and password, that they'll be in the description. The one to SSH into the machine is the one that you set through the interface in the portal.
Yeah, so if I want, full access to that underlying Linux VM, that's going to be specified when you create that VM. And that you could utilize, obviously, for Linux VMs, you could utilize that certificate or the username and password that you specify, which is different than the password for the Jenkins or the actual app or service that's on top of there. Something to point out. So once I've done this, really, right, I now have Jenkins up here. I've logged into the console, but where is the Azure integration? Well, there's a number of different places, and I'll highlight a couple of them here. If we go into Manage Jenkins, it's important to point out under Manage Plugins. Here we can see Manage Plugins list, and what I'll do is just click on this, and I've already installed the Azure-related plugins here. So if I go to down this list, go to Windows Azure, although maybe that's something down the road we'll upgrade for the name. But we have the storage plugin and the slaves plugin here. And of course, I have to draw a smiley face because we're getting towards the end of the day and we have to keep you happy right now.
I'm just about to issue a pull request on
there. Okay, I was going to say, well, Ross is creating a pull request to change the name. We'll kind of keep going with this demo. So that shows you the two major places, the Windows Slaves plugin and the Azure Storage plugin. How do we configure that? I'm gonna focus on the Azure Storage plugin for having the build artifacts connected up to your storage account. So if I go back to the dashboard, and then I go to Manage Jenkins, and then we go to 1 second here, Configure System up top. That'll take a second to pop up. And then I have to scroll all the way down to the bottom. And here we have our connection point. So here we have Microsoft Azure Storage Account Configuration. There is where I will put my storage account name. Now in my case here, if I snap back to my storage account, let me go over here. I have a storage account called VM Depot OSS. Okay, within here I have the blob storage URL. Every storage account, right, has blobs, tables, and queues. In this case, we're going to be storing those artifacts in blob storage. And then I also have an access key. This access key, when we click on this list, right, it is going to give you a ability to have that access into that storage account. So that's what I'm specifying here. If you wanted to, let's say choose a private repo or a public repo, it's up to you on making sure you lock that down. But this blob service endpoint URL would actually be this list here. What you see is this URL that you'd specify to have it upload and securely upload those build artifacts in there. So after I've done this, of course, I could add different storage accounts for different things, but then it comes to the build process. So let me go back to my homepage, and I've actually already created a new item. And within this new item, I could go in and change this or configure this new build workflow. I've called it MVA. I could do all kinds of custom things, which I don't have time to get into today. But after the build all happens, I would do a post-build action, which is upload artifacts to Microsoft Azure Blob Storage. So when I click on this list, how about that? I've got a drop-down here, which says VM Depot OSS, based on that storage account connection I created earlier. I can also say I want to put it inside of a different container name. I want to, you know, do a number of different options, clean the container before uploading, allow, you know, various configurations here so that every after the build happens, I have a repo in Azure to store those build artifacts.
So what you're doing here in terms of release management is you're saying, here's our build, it's a completed build, it went through the whole process, all the tests have been done and everything, and here it is in blob storage, ready for deployment.
Right.
So you're one step closer.
Yeah, you're one step closer now. This doesn't, you know, if you look through what I've said here and what you just mentioned, it doesn't go through the continuous deployment. But this could, you know, be one thing, one step towards that direction, right? Because, for instance, things like Azure websites, right? The way that you could command line provision a full Azure website, it needs a build of the website, which is actually a zip file, right? And that zip file needs to be stored in blob storage if you want to automate the provisioning of that, you know, in a quick fashion. So you could, let's say theoretically, if you're using Azure websites, have it, you know, build that, push that build artifact into the Azure storage, and then have a script that after the fact goes and provisions based on that known build into an Azure account. So that would be kind of a connection point here on how you might utilize Jenkins and tie that into a release management, start of a release management pipeline for your company. So with that, that's kind of the end of my Jenkins demo here. So you should know now how to get a master Jenkins image created inside of Microsoft Azure, and at least know a little more about how to get things connected, you know, connect up to it and start those two Azure plugin configurations and where they're at in your environment. I want to shift now to kind of a story that we have within Microsoft, because we have a product that is really relevant to call out here, which is release management for Visual Studio, or Visual Studio release management. And this kind of comes back to the high-level idea of what we're trying to achieve with the overall structure, is that you've got some source code repository. In this case, we call it TFS. And, you know, you need a way to automate the deployments between those different environments. Here we have four. It could be two, could be three, whatever. But you need a way to consistently move it through the system. You know, you need to also, ideally, right, you want to have a workflow. You want to have an approval workflow of when it goes into prod, I want to, at a bare minimum, I want to have an audit trail to know what's actually happened and who actually executed that. And for some companies, right, they actually want to know, you know, they want to have somebody that says, I approve to go to production, you know. I mean, it could be a checkbox to say approve and then it goes and happens, but they want some means of control in their environment. It could be security or regulatory reasons for that purpose, but nonetheless, that is an important thing that some people, you know, need inside of their systems. The other thing is, you know, you want to deploy it the same way to all your different systems, right? And there may be certain, like we mentioned before, there may be certain variables that need to change, but you need to have a system that supports that flowing and those minor tweaks across those different environments. And again, you want to also have, ideally, full traceability. You want to know what's going on and what's changed across these different environments, not just what's changed in one of them, but can I see a pattern? Can I see what's actually happening if something breaks? Or maybe I want to do some analysis of things that are going on, do reports or other things. It could be auditing or security purposes, but you want to have traceability across that pipeline. You know, so what is this? What does release management do? Well, it can do a lot of different things. You don't have to use it for all of this, but it can connect to your configuration and infrastructure as code scripts. So we've talked about these things here earlier. You can actually use Chef, for instance, to provision the underlying infrastructure as part of the pipeline deployments. You can also, you know, of course, configure the app, install the app on top of it. You can create test data, automated tests, or do tests on top of that as part of this workflow, and you can have approval. And of course, like we mentioned earlier, traceability, audibility through this entire pipeline. So really, you have a lot here, right? You've got a system to help you manage that full stack across there. And of course, you may plug into different systems throughout that overall life cycle. How does it actually work, though? How does release management work? And again, we have not enough time to give you a depth view of release management. There's a full-blown MVA course on this, but we at least want to give you a rough idea. So TFS, let's say, plugs into a drop location and a release management server. That release management server then enables you to push to the different environments. The other nice thing here is that release management has a web console built in and allows somebody, if maybe it's a release manager person, that says, or a boss, it could be a boss that checks the box that says, a go, allow these 50 changes or two changes or whatever to go into production. You know, they approve it, and then from there, right, it then goes and pushes out all those changes to the various environments and does all of that orchestration for you, and again, has that audibility and traceability across those environments. Now, that being said, if there wasn't for this next slide, I may have not actually even covered release management at all, because so far we've been really talking mostly, right, about a Microsoft product. But there is integration, and there will be continued investments in integration so that there is more connectivity into all different types of environments. So if we go to the next slide here, you can see that there's ability with that release management service and product to plug into various things, Puppet, Chef, PowerShell, DSC, things to where, you know, you can do a lot of automation and connect up a lot of the concepts that we've talked about earlier today with infrastructure, configuration as code, put those into this system, right, where you have an efficient way to push those things through those different environments.
Yeah, and I think this slide, it gives us a good idea of why Microsoft is doing this, why Microsoft is engaging with all of these open source technologies out there. And it really boils down to being able to innovate at a very fast pace. We have tooling that is already in use, as you were talking about there. There's plenty of tooling there. And there's also lots of open source things out there that do things in a slightly different way, or for a slightly different use case, or for a different language set, or for all things that are important in a cloud-first world where we need to support all platforms, all languages, all sets of tooling. And so our engagement with the open source tools and making them work in this environment is to allow us to do that kind of integration. So it's all about building a whole tool chain, if you like, of the best of all of the different options that are out there for us.
Yeah, and I should also really hit on the fact that if you use release management, you could have an entirely open source stack for your whole software. It could be, the rest of it could be nothing Microsoft. You could have right. Linux on a Apache and a MySQL and a whatever, right? The whole rest of the stack and the app could be nothing related to Microsoft. It could be a Java app and whatever, right? It's the release management is there to help you with the flow of moving everything through that system. And the other thing I should point out is that really recently we announced that we have release management as a service. So not only is it a box product, but we also have integration into Visual Studio Online. So some of this functionality is now starting to surface in the Visual Studio Online service. So that way you can still utilize some of these capabilities without having to do an actual VM install of the product itself. So let's recap and kind of close out here. You know, Jenkins and Hudson, they are good for right things like, you know, continuous integration and creating builds, and there's a number of connection points right that you have up to Azure and spreading out, let's say, the load for builds and things like that. But I think, you know, hopefully you're starting to kind of see a little bit of where something like a release management product starts to kind of provide a broader story in the overall flow of the pipeline, right? Where you're providing, you know, a tool that's designed for that end-to-end process, designed for multiple environments, designed for the traceability, designed for a lot of the things that, you know, you would expect from a release pipeline for customers to utilize, right? And so it really, and that service will also, of course, integrate within a number of different tools that you have to do those infrastructure as code and provisioning things in your system. So kind of, I mean, we've covered kind of the whole lot here. The last step that we're going to dive into next is the monitoring. And for this, I want to thank Ross for his time today and helping out with all these different modules, because now you're going to, that's it. You're
great.
You're gone.
I can go now.
Excellent.
You can. So thanks a lot for spending your time with us. It's been great here. And well, I look forward to doing some more stuff.
Okay, so we've covered release management and getting the code and your application all the way into production. At some point, though, you're going to probably need to monitor and learn from that app, which is running in production. And for that right now, I'd like to boot Ross off stage and invite Jeff on board here to talk a little bit about that. So here we have monitoring and learning as our final module for the course of the day. And as you'll see here, welcome, Jeff, to this course. Thank you for joining us. Could you tell our audience a little bit about who you are and what you do here?
Yeah, my name is Jeff Mendoza. I'm a software engineer at Microsoft Open Technologies. And I work on Linux and DevOps tools on Microsoft Azure, open source ones. And I wrote the code for the Nagios plugins that monitor Azure.
Okay, well, I think nobody better than to talk about that topic than the creator of that plugin. Yep. So that's pretty sweet. But before we let you go into all the details and the specifics, I'd love our audience right now to get a little better feel of some of the integration points that Microsoft has with open source software and these plugins. So first off, super, super high level here, right? We're talking Nagios and Zabbix have ways to monitor Azure infrastructure. So we'll dive into a little more specifically. What is Nagios? Well, Nagios is a piece of software that enables you to do various types of monitoring. And as it relates to Microsoft, we have a plugin for Nagios that enables folks to monitor storage, VMs, Azure, cloud services, back into that central console. So, you know, if you're a customer and you've got existing investments in, let's say, Nagios, you're doing anything to deploying to Azure, you might want to have just still a single place for all of that information for monitoring and learning from your environments. You may be having Nagios monitor all kinds of other things, even outside of Azure. And this plugin would really help you to consolidate that viewpoint in that world. Why might we use it, though? Why might somebody use Nagios? There's a lot of different reasons here. There's no way that we are going to dive into every single scenario of where people might be using Nagios. You know, at a very high level, right, you need to learn from your environments. I mean, it's a pretty foundational concept, right? You need to be able to detect when problems happen, when there's security breaches, you know, when problems are surfacing, you need to be able to react and do something about that. And you know, at the bottom of this slide that you see here, you can access the link to learn about this project that we've enabled this integration point. Next up, we have Zabbix, and Zabbix is very similar in nature in the function that it does. Now, you'll notice on this slide there's architectural changes with the way Zabbix works, where you have right proxies and this highly available cluster and all these other things. But at the core of it, right, you're doing the same kind of concept here. You know, you're having, you know, a place where you do that monitoring, and you're now extending that monitoring capabilities to be able to monitor the storage, the VMs, the SQL, and the cloud services that you may be running inside of Microsoft Azure. So why might you use Zabbix, you might ask? Well, you know, it's a different pivot, right, of the same kind of story, right, with different tweaks, you know, is that, hey, you need to monitor things, you need to make sure everything's highly available, you need to make sure that there's, you know, the right kinds of capacity for the infrastructure that you're running. And, of course, we have this this plugging for monitoring and alerting that ties into Zabbix as well. So with that, I will stop talking because we have the expert here who we'd love to dig in and understand, you know, kind of how things work.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So first thing I want to talk about is what the things you can monitor in Azure. Now, we wrote some plugins that monitor specific things, and those talk to the Azure APIs because those are Azure-specific things to monitor. But with that said, you can monitor Azure VMs in the same way you would monitor any other VM or machine that you have with your typical agents or agentless monitoring that you might install. But what I have here are the properties that you can manage with the plugins that we wrote. And you can see the list. There's the basic compute, storage, database. Some more interesting things that you might not be aware of are Azure Diagnostics, which monitor our PaaS platforms. and an Active Directory plugin that we wrote that can use the Graph API that can do differential queries. So I'm going to dive into each one of these in more detail and then show you how to use some of those. But first, before we start using the plugins, let's figure out how to install them and configure them on your Nagios instance. So the plugins are a Python package. And if you're used to installing Python packages, these should look really familiar. If you're not, it's as easy as typing pip install Azure Monitor, assuming you have pip installed on your Linux distribution of choice. I'm going to go ahead and click on the package page so that we can take a look at the README and the installation guide. If you don't have pip or you don't want to use pip, it's also easy to download the package and install it yourself. There's some setup required, and I'll go over that when I show you the demo in a second. And then you move on to configuring your Nagios configuration files to do the checks. I set up a Azure VM, and also I chose OpenLogic CentOS 7 for my distro. It doesn't really matter what you use, what you like, the Nagios plugins will install the same. And then I chose to use the Nagios packages in the Fedora EPL repository for my setup. And one more thing I also wanted to show was that we have Nagios XI available in VM Depot. Now, Nagios XI is the paid version of Nagios, so you will need a license to be able to use this image. Okay, so let's move on to the Compute plugin. So the Compute plugin is pretty basic. It just gets you the status of your cloud service or your VM, whether it's up and running or shut down. Something that you could get using other means as well, but this one is coming from the Azure API, so if you want to have multiple sources. One of the things that you need for most of the plugins is a published settings file, and if you're familiar with Azure, this shouldn't be unfamiliar to you. You can just download it with this link. I'm not going to click this because it goes ahead and creates a new one and downloads it for you. And I also wanted to point out that the source of the Compute plugin is the Service Management REST API. And that's your typical Azure API that's used to create instances and destroy instances and do other management on instances. So I'm going to switch over to my Nagios machine and show you a little bit of my setup. I'm also going to switch back to the install instructions so I can show you how I set up the plugins. After you install the plugins with pip, it's going to install them in user bin. And so you can make some simple sim links here to put those in your Nagios directory. And actually, one thing I want to point out here is that the reason why we put them in user bin and not somewhere specific for Nagios is because, one, Nagios can install into different directories depending on your distro, but also that these plugins can be useful for Zabbix too. We have Zabbix directions down here. Or they can be used in other ways. Like if Nagios plugins can just be run and you can collect the status however you want. So we want to install them in a friendly directory. Also, let me show you my published settings file. So here I showed you the links.
Yeah, that and that published settings file is gonna something we talked a little bit about earlier. But I mean, that's gonna generate your certificates that enable you to securely communicate and modify that subscription. And that once you have that enabled, that is a subscription do anything type of access.
Okay, so I have my published settings file here. I put it in the etc Nagios private directory because that's a secure directory where you can store it. It does contain sensitive information that allows people to, if they were to get hold of it, to access your Azure subscription. And so I want to also show you the config that I have for the published settings file. My resource config, I have a user variable here. And you'll see that on my other configurations.
So that resource.config, what does that enable? Just the connection from the plugin to the Azure subscription?
So it's a place to store common variables where you want to use later and to keep them private. Okay. So if you want to have usernames and passwords, which I'll show you with the SQL plugin, and also like these things like your published settings file, you'll put those there. And then in the rest of your Nagios config, you'll just reference those variables.
OK, that makes sense.
So I followed the instructions here and set up the plugins. And now I'm going to jump into setting up a check for my compute instance. So my Nagios config is here under objects. And first thing I did was I set up a command for check Azure compute. If you're familiar with Nagios, then it should be straightforward. Otherwise, it's just running the check Azure compute command, the host name for the instance you're monitoring, and then I'm sending that published settings file, that user2 variable. I want to show you one more thing here. Now that you have the command defined in Nagios, you can then define a host to use that command. So here I have a host in Azure called jlmtest, and I want to use the check Azure compute command here. And I'd set it up to not take any arguments, so it'll just get the status.
So there you could kind of define a template of maybe an array of different servers that you want to access, and
Absolutely.
Even maybe a set of types of things you want to check.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And for since I don't have an agent installed on my JLM test machine, right now I'm only checking SSH because that's available to the outside world. But then I'm also added the Azure status, which is using that compute plugin.
Okay. Oh, so when you do that configuration file, that now shows up in the dashboard.
Yes, it does. Yeah, that configuration file is how you drive Nagios and tell it which machines to monitor and what to monitor on those machines. Okay. So just to show you that it's working, I'm going to go ahead and shut down this machine. Make sure I'm shutting down the right one. And then I'm going to reschedule the check on that.
Critical. Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's down. Oh, what are we going to do? Ah.
Yeah, so, again, it's a pretty basic up-down, but it's pulling from the Azure APIs. And then we took that one first and built upon this compute plugin to write all the other plugins, which I'll go ahead to the next one.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's cool.
The next one is the storage. So the source for the storage is Storage Analytics, which is something you turn on in your Azure subscription. And then once you have Storage Analytics turned on, you can then monitor the counters that are being stored by Azure into those tables. I'm going to show you in my Azure portal how I went ahead and enabled Storage Analytics for my storage account. And I believe this is the one I'm monitoring. Yes.
Another good reason to name your storage accounts beforehand.
Yeah.
Then do dynamically create.
Yeah, this was the portal generated one. Configure. Yeah, so in configure, you just go here under monitoring, and you can turn on monitoring for your blobs, tables, or queues, and then decide how long you want to store that data and what sort of monitoring level you want. So you must turn this on to be able to use the Nagios plugin for monitoring your storage.
And does it have to be verbose, or can it be minimal?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's better to err on the side of caution. Do the verbose, and get more data that you need for if something happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And the Azure API is always improving.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a problem in all open source, and something that we strive to do is to kind of keep track and stay on top of those types of things. So when Azure comes out with new counters or new tables or new things to monitor, then we want to go and say, hey, how can we enable this in the various open source platforms that we contribute to? And so people can use all of that information.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So I'll go ahead and show you the command I set up for storage. Since the storage plugin is a lot more powerful, it can detect a lot more things. There's something called a key here, which is something that you pass and tell the storage plugin what tracker you want to monitor, because it has so many. And I'm going to show you the list of keys that we have here. I have some links in the slides, so anybody wants to go and check these things out, feel free to go and click on these. So for example, our storage plugin can monitor your ingress, egress, requests, billable requests, and a lot of other counters that are automatically stored by Azure. And then I set up a check on the requests. So here is the basic command for storage. And if we go back to my configuration for my storage account, I decided that my check command is going to be check requests. And if there are 1,000, give me a warning. If there are 10,000, give me an error. And if we go back to my Nagios machine, here's my storage account that I have set up, and it's giving me a warning saying, oh, I have had 6,400 requests recently, and that's above my warning threshold.
Okay.
So you can set these to, you know, your expected amount of traffic or whatever you're tracking, so you can get the right kind of alerts.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah. And this one thing I forgot to mention about this is it does go ahead and this is an hourly statistic, so this happens to be 6,400 in the last hour. SQL database is our SQL Nagios plugin, and it can get information from what we call dynamic management views, which are a set of SQL queries that you send out to your Azure SQL database, and it can get you certain information. Similarly to the storage plugin, since this plugin can get so many different things, we have this key idea, which is this parameter here. Sorry about that. And I'm going to go ahead and click on this list of keys so that you can see which keys we're going to monitor. I set up my demo to monitor the database size of the database that I have set up, but as you can see, there's a lot of different things to monitor here for things that you might be interested in getting alerts on. Let's see. Here's my Azure database I have set up here. And the check that I have on this is I want to check the DB size of my JLM DB and give me a warning if it's 1 meg or critical if it's 10. It's a small database.
Yeah, we gotta generate some fun data here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than 1 meg. That's just so we can see something fun. That's good, right?
Yeah, and again, here, the same sort of warning that you're seeing on the storage, you're also seeing on the database that my database happens to be over 1 meg. So
it seems like when you're modifying this definition, and then as soon as you modify it and commit it, now it shows up in the console. Now it starts to give you the data based on what that definition is.
It's not instant. I have all this saved already, and,
okay.
And if you do change the config files, you do have to restart Nagios.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
But it is something that you go ahead and set up how you want, and then have it run once you have it set up how you want it.
Okay.
So I don't have demos for the last two plugins, but they're, you know, as you can see, it's pretty straightforward. They all kind of work the same way. You set up your Nagios config to run the check and give it the parameters that you want to give it, and it tells you what's working and what's not. For PaaS, our PaaS monitor, we use the Azure Diagnostics. And Azure Diagnostics is something that can plug into the .NET runtime and give you some interesting information that you can't always get from an agent, like things like exceptions per second or the memory usage of your particular app, not just of the whole machine. So you would be able to see the list of keys you can monitor if you just go ahead and click the link. And then similarly, you know, give it your warn level and crit level for that particular monitoring. I also want to mention that with Azure Diagnostics is something that you have to enable in your PaaS package.
Yeah, and then that has also, Azure Diagnostics has limitations as well on the duration of recording of information as well, right?
Yes, so yes.
In that particular case, you can't get it like every 5 seconds or something like that, right?
Yes, yes, like storage and Azure Diagnostics, those things are taking the data and then putting those into tables. and those tables are stored in Azure. And then we want to make sure that they don't get too big, and we want to decide how much is stored. So when you set up the configuration for both of those things, you decide how much data you want to save, and then the Nagios plugins just pull those out.
Yeah, so that's a very good point to just to hit on again, is that if you set up an alert rule that you want to know data that's older than, let's say, 7 days, which I think in many cases is the default storage duration, then you need to have that foundational setup before you even touch Nagios, which mirrors the kind of duration and settings you want.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
Okay. All right. So I think you have the Active Directory is the one last thing that you had in the list, right, on the slide?
Yes, I did.
And then maybe?
Yeah, so Active Directory is the final plugin, and it uses what's called the Graph API. And if you want to read more about it, you can click this link. And there's not a lot to monitor on Active Directory that you might want to get alerts on. Mostly the information you can get from the Graph API is like your users and groups and things like that. But one thing that might be interesting that you can get from the Graph API is what we call differential queries, which you can query like users in a group or number of groups or number of users total, and then query it the next time and see if there's been a difference. So that's something that you might want to alert on if you want to make sure that nobody's changing things that you don't want them to. And again, the usage for Active Directory is pretty much straightforward. You give it the right credentials to access your Azure account, and then the right thing that you want to monitor.
Just to be clear, that's Azure Active Directory you're monitoring, not regular Active Directory on
this
a VM.
True.
So
yeah,
just to make sure we're clear on that. Okay.
Yes.
And you know, just to side pivot here. I mean, if you are using Azure Active Directory, there are quite a bit of reports and other analytics that we give native inside of Azure itself and Azure Active Directory, such as, you know, if you have a premium account, there's a whole slew of like security alerts, auditing type things that we do just native to Azure, but I just wanted to make sure we called that out. Okay,
yep.
So thank you so much, Jeff, for the knowledge on these plugins here.
Yeah.
I think they look really, really great. So
all right, well,
done,
thanks
done
for
great
having
work.
Me.
Yeah. So with that, I wanna kind of close us out for the day, right? We've gone through a lot of things here, and I wanna just do a quick recap here with a few slides before we close out. One of which here is this heterogeneous slide that I have here that we talked about all the way at the beginning of the day. As you can see here, I mean, we've really covered pretty much all of these technologies in the list that are at least in have colors anyway to them. and by no means is this a finished list, right? In the MS Open Tech team, you know, they are continuing to evolve upon the projects that they're working on and even enhancing and working on new things for the existing integration points that we have in our overall ecosystem. I also want to just do one quick shout out. We've spent a lot of time today talking about open source. Just another highlight of the fact that there are tons of complementary tools that are there that you could use in addition to maybe what you're using for on the open source side of the house. And so I think there's a lot of great complements in your overall ecosystem. At Microsoft, we don't believe you have to use all Microsoft to get things done. We think there's a great way where you can use both to accomplish the goals that you desire. So what I would say as kind of a final call to action here is give it a go, right? I mean, check out the link we have there, which is the current list of all of the DevOps related projects. There are a ton of other open source projects we have at Microsoft that are outside of the DevOps space. You know, if there's a problem that you see, hey, issue a pull request, submit us, comment on the GitHub repos, let us know that there's things you'd like to see differently. Get started with an Azure trial and start playing around with things. And then last but not least, you know, definitely check out, if you'd love to know more about DevOps, there's quite a few resources that we have here so that you can learn more about the broader story of DevOps beyond just these open source tools primarily that we focused on today. Okay, so with that, there is a lot that we've talked about. You know, make sure that you fill out the eval survey that we have down below on this course, and make sure that you know, you just continue on and continue the dialogue and the conversation. DevOps is a journey. Thank you all so much for joining us.